Hey, this is Dave Broadbeck. I'm your instructor. Unless you're not just listening to this for fun because you're some kind of person who listens to university lectures for fun. I was going to insult you. I decided against it. So person who's listening to this for fun, I'm not going to insult you. Anyway, I'm Dave Broadbeck here at Algoma University, and you're about to listen to a lecture from the fall 2023 term of Psychology 3106, Animal Behavior. It's what the cool kids study in school. Sorry, I didn't mean to yell there. Hope you enjoy it. And if you don't, well, I still get paid, so I don't really care.
That's awesome. Because mostly that's great just because it is disturbing to a lot of people, which makes it more fun.
Absolutely.
Right. If you just joined us on the podcast of lectures, we're talking about Satanism. however, we're going to move over now and talk about the evolution of behavior. We may also get, we will get into adaptation today too. These are two topics that fit together really nicely. So why not? I will also probably send you a YouTube link to a show that's an old thing. It's from like 30 years ago, and you know what? And it's even out of date, but it shows the how the comparative method works, and it's very cool, so I'll send it to you. Anyway, right, so we've looked at causal mechanisms really so far, right? We've looked at development, genes, neurons, so looked at brains. We've looked at the concept of functional things. We just haven't looked at them. At it from an evolutionary, like individual behaviors or that kind of thing. We've looked at the idea of looking at things from evolutionary history, but behavior also has an evolutionary history. It has to, because it's just another characteristic. I think the biggest, if I can get you to take away one thing from this course, it's that behavior is just another characteristic of an animal. I'd like you to take away more things than that, but that's a pretty important one. So, we can look at the origin of a behavior, and we can look at how it changes over time. And we can look at the fitness consequences of it. Those are two things. The second part, the fitness consequences, is the next topic, which is adaptation. Today, and these are obviously very related, but looking at the sort of historical pathway of, and when I say historical, I mean evolutionarily historical. Over time, how has a behavior changed? Doing that is a different thing than looking at the fitness consequences, but clearly they're related. These things wouldn't show up and be maintained. Not show up, but they wouldn't be maintained or propagate if they didn't have positive fitness consequences, right? All right. Thing here. Okay, so these are obviously related points, and like I said, the second topic that we'll get into today, which is adaptation, is the second topic here. So, if we want to reconstruct evolution, the first thing you tend to do when you think about, well, this is the first thing I think of, and I do behavior stuff, but I still think about, when I think about the evolution of something, I think about go to the fossil record. Let's look at the fossils. Let's go dig some stuff up, and then you find out that behavior as a rule doesn't fossilize very well. You can infer a lot of things from fossils if you get a lot of them. So if you get fossils and there are what's clearly a nest site that has some eggs, but it's also got some live young and a mother, and like a male and a female, you can make some pretty good thing. You can say there's parental care in the species. Right, you can just say that. That seems reasonable. There's biparental care in the species. Like a mother and a father, male and a female. Okay, so they kind of can fossilize. I think I told you about the example of the, there are fossilized footprints of a a young woman holding her hand of her child, who's a toddler. And you can tell they're holding hands because of the way the footfalls are and how how the footprints have gone. So you can actually see that this person, who was probably not even an age sapiens, probably like a Heidelbergensis, used to hold their kid's hand. That tells us something about parental care humans going back before they were age sapiens. Yep.
I was thinking like early human or Neanderthal or something like that had like a broken leg, and that kind of signified that they were, yeah, okay.
Yeah, because if you live after a broken leg, that means somebody's caring for you.
Yeah.
I've had a broken leg.
It's hard.
And you don't get around very easily.
Yeah.
So you die, like...
On your own.
Yeah, on your own you die, because you can't get up to get any food. But if people have cared for you and it's actually healed, that means people have let you lie down and do nothing while they go out and hunt the mastodons, right? So that tells, again, that can tell us something. Looking at the remains that are left in caves and things like that for human evolution can tell us some things, but generally behavior hasn't fossilized well. We make a lot of probably reasonable, but sometimes probably unreasonable assumptions. So what else can we do? The key thing really is using the comparative method. So what we do is we look at related species, and we look at any behavior that is widespread. And if it's evolved in a common ancestor of that species, of a couple of species, then we know it comes from somewhere earlier, right? If it only exists in one or a few species, it must be more recent. That's just logic, right? Make sense? Yeah? Okay. So I think I talked about, no, don't say that now. You're going to say that at the end. There's a reason the examples come to mind sometimes. Oh, because those are examples I'm going to use. Little hint, a little look behind the curtains, behind the hair on the fourth wall. Sometimes I don't really look at my notes before class. Or I do this. Oh, it's that stuff. Okay. Hey, look, an example. Let's talk about empid flies. Why not? Empid flies are neat little animals, little flies. I think I had a picture. Here we go. So they're not huge, right? That's a little fly. And their courtship ritual is fascinating because it involves the male presenting a silk gift to the female. Okay? So he gives her a gift, which is nice because, you know, why not? Of course, what's he doing here? He's giving her a gift in exchange for a mating opportunity. He's buying her dinner, and he's being presumptuous. Because, as usual, men are pigs. So, in most related species, closely related species, or really all these kind of flies, the females are way bigger than the men. So actually, the male usually ends up being dinner. Oh, he gets a mating opportunity. But that's the last one he's going to get. He's going to die with a smile on his face, but he's going to die. So, and in fact, in praying mantises, this is pretty common, and there is one species of mantis where the male actually is more efficient at depositing his sperm without a head.
Without?
A head. So the female rips his head off, and of course, then he gets really good.
Because he's not thinking as much.
Why would that behavior come about?
Which one? Ripping the head off?
Yeah.
Why would it come about? In fact, because you might think, well, that's not advantageous to the male, unless his head gives a lot of nourishment to his mate, who then can have viable offspring.
Fair enough.
Yeah, evolution's nasty. It's not about living or dying, it's about passing on genes. It's one of these things I'm not gonna say it, forget it. I have a whole thing, but I decided not to say it.
Okay.
Yeah, I'll leave that alone. Maybe some other time. So in some species of these related flies, the males present food to the females. The function of this, in fact, is to distract the female so she doesn't kill him, so he can get away. And hopefully have another mating opportunity with another female.
Right? So he brings her some food. He goes, hey, look, I brought you a hamburger. And then, well, not probably a hamburger, because that's pretty big for a fly. Still others adorn it with silk strands. I like to think of this as a as wrapping on the present. I brought you something. And it's just strands of silk covering some whatever the hell a fly is going to eat, a breadcrumb. This does a couple things. Makes the thing more conspicuous. Makes it, it's obvious that, that this getting this, what are called nuptial gifts. I love that it's used nuptial, like they're getting married. Mm. Do you fly, take this other fly until you eat its head? But it makes it more conspicuous, and it takes a little longer to eat. If it takes longer to eat, he has more chance of finishing his sexual business and moving on to do that somewhere else. Elizabeth.
So, do you know how they rip the head off?
No.
Good question. I don't know if they have teeth.
Like this. Get off my back! Yeah, I don't actually know. Literally, I don't know how that works. It's funny. That's a good question.
Maybe like rips it up into like little pieces.
Yeah.
Just rip it up and just eat it.
Yeah. Or like tears parts of the head off slowly.
Well, it must be that he's already mounted her because he wouldn't be able to do that without a head on.
Right.
Because he wouldn't be able to detect where she is. Right? So it must be him.
I mean, he'd probably run away if she did it before.
Yeah, or she went after him. It's like, no, look, I just said you look nice. I didn't. Again, some of these I edit out and just, but they're darn funny to me. Others cover it completely with silk. So now you wrap the whole thing up. Now it's gonna take even longer to open, and it's a little more obvious, and again, now he gets more chance for his mating opportunity. I don't know how long it takes for flies. I'm not sure I even want to know, but it's enough that it distracts. This one's great. This shows you how stupid evolution can be. Because if this was designed, you wouldn't do a thing where if you're the male, you're flying around and go, oh, good, here's a thing I can bring to a girl and I can get her to have sex with me. And I go, first I'll put some silk all over it, now I'll take it all off and eat it.
That's what they do.
Yeah. Then here's the silk. This is like when a guy buys a shitty present for you, right, women? This is like when he buys you a TV for your partner because you'll have a TV.
Buys them something that they want to use themselves.
Yeah, that's why I mentioned the TV, because I'm not saying I did that in 1988 for Christmas, but I did. Yeah, I bought my wife, it was just a little TV. She had no TV, she was my wife then. Because we were talking, yeah, she had a girlfriend, and I said, you have a TV. So I bought her TV. I thought that was nice. You buy somebody a TV for Christmas. She said, well, you bought this, you can watch hockey games when you're at my place. And I said, well, hockey games will be on television, so I guess probably. So to make up for it, I bought a cable box for her and I stole cable from her neighbors. And then she said, so is this so you can watch more hockey games? And I said, well, this will give me more chance to watch more hockey games, so yes. It's amazing that we've been together for 35 years. Yes. And finally, we get to the end. Yeah, some actually just, this is, the next step is make some silk. Don't do the food, because that's obviously a waste of time. You can see how that mutation happened. It's like, here's a crazy idea. Let's not just find some food, cover it in silk, remove the silk, eat the food, wrap the silk all back up and give it to someone. Why don't we just give her the silk? Genius! See, evolution's stupid. It works with what it has in front of it.
Where do they get the silk?
Oh, they can express it like through spinnerets, just like a.
That's so cool.
We'd call it a spider. Yeah.
I didn't know flies did that.
Yeah, some flies can. Yeah. Some other insects can too, and some worms can. Some silkworms.
That's true.
Oh, yeah. Silkworms.
Yeah. Where do you think silk comes from? Yeah.
Yeah.
Silkworms. In fact, there are new genetically modified silkworms that can create a. A cloth that is more bulletproof than Kevlar.
Yeah, I heard about that.
They're genetically modified. Yeah, it just came out. There's a paper about this like 3 days ago.
Awesome.
Yes.
Or I heard about them trying to do that.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. All right, so let's talk about flight, because this is something that's kind of wild. When the first bird, and there is what it likely looked like.
That's sick.
it's a scary flying dino bird. That's what that is. That's it. See, you have to remember that dinosaur, that birds, modern birds are dinosaurs. And that's not me just saying that to be an idiot. Like, they literally are dinosaurs. This is something, by the way, that 30 years ago, nobody said that. Or people said it, people thought, yeah, okay, sure. And now everybody knows it. It's a lot of times my minority opinions get more evidence. That's a lot of times how science works. Here's a fossil from Archaeopteryx here. Look at that beautiful fossil. The tail there, it's freaking beautiful.
Does it have claws on its wings?
Oh yeah, it's got claws on its wings. You did not, now, this thing's the size of a turkey. It's not like, you, if it came after you, you'd go, fuck you. Oh, but yeah. It wouldn't be a problem. Like, you wouldn't have any problems fighting an Archaeopteryx. However, this thing running at you with claws on the end of its wings and teeth in its bill, and it's yelling, ah! Yeah. That's scary.
Yeah.
It'd be disturbing.
Turkeys aren't small.
No, but they're not huge either. Like, they don't frighten me. Like, if a turkey came at me, I wouldn't go, I'd probably get out of the way.
Yeah.
But if it came down to it, I can take a turkey.
Part of that's because you know they're so stupid.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
If they were smarter, it'd be more formidable.
They probably couldn't run at you in a straight line. Yeah. With that thing, I would, like, not fuck with that.
Yeah. It's also fair. It's a fair point you're making.
Yeah.
Don't misunderstand. So this was discovered in the 1880s, and it's given the name Archaeopteryx, which means ancient bird. Which is the name of one of my computers.
Yeah.
Here's the question, how did it fly? Because for a long time, there were two competing theories of where flight came from. One thought it was dinosaurs, birds. Another one thought it was well before that this way happened. So the YouTube link I'll send you about this TV program called Paleo World, Dinosaurs in the Air. It's great. Even though, like I said, one guy's wrong about everything, because he's the guy who doesn't think they come from dinosaurs, right? But it's still really great, and it shows you how science works. So I'll send you that after class. Did it fly from tree to tree? Did it run and take off? Right, so from tree to tree, if it can get up a tree, it could just jump and soar. Yeah, or like a bird. A lot of birds just can soar, right? Yeah, just look, if you look at, watch, not like a slow songbird, but if you watch like ducks or geese or eagles or whatever, they can just put their wings out and just hang out.
Isn't that kind of how they learn to fly too? Like when they jump out of the nest? Like they just sort of like...
Well, I mean, learning...
Yeah.
There is some learning there, but it's the same as you learning to swim if you were
thrown in
a month old. You can learn to swim pretty quickly if you threw in a pool.
Okay.
Yeah.
And genetically it would make sense.
Yeah, exactly.
Be
right.
Better at that.
Yeah, exactly. Or did it run and take off? When you think about birds today, right? We think about birds today, we usually think about a couple of steps, they jump and they put their wings in the air and there's a power of flight, right? So did it fly like that? But your squirrel example is a good example too, because squirrels can, you know, flying squirrels, Rocket J Squirrel from Rocky and Bullwinkle, which probably none of you people know what that is. Go look it up and watch all the Rocky and Bullwinkle cartoons. The wings and feathers had claws. So the wings and feathers were modern, and the wings had claws. The claws and the wings are interesting because they aren't for manipulating anything, are they?
No.
Just look at the way they are.
It just looks cool.
They could be for swiping at things and killing them. It can also be for grabbing on a tree as you climb up.
I was
going
to say it's very bat-like.
Yeah, right? It's feathers and wings were modern. There are, I got the species name written down here. I don't want to screw this up.
What about the beak? Like, that doesn't have a beak. Where did it take
It's got like a, it's
it
like a
like
beak.
A...
It's not, it's a proto-beak you could call it, but it does have beak, but it has teeth.
Sharp, sharp teeth.
But it's not like a lizard mouth, because that's what
no. It's much more like a beak.
Okay.
And this is an older artist rendering.
Yes.
The better they get. This thing probably looked like a really weird turkey with claws on its wings. Mm-hmm. That's the best guess we have now. Okay. We know it had modern-looking feathers. It had flight feathers. Now, flight feathers are wild because there's different kinds of feathers. Right? Feathers almost certainly evolved as a way to keep the young warm. Right, that's where feathers come from, probably. But a little tweak makes them asymmetrical, and it gives them lift, and allows flight, which is, you know, pretty great. So it had flight feathers. And if you take a look at some of the other species here of, I got to make sure I get these names right. So I got to read these. Whoa, I'm not going to read that in that font. Jesus, what's that even say now? Let's see. Arcanoris, Ciotingia, and Aurornis are other ones that are early birdish-like dinosaurs. So others have been discovered. And very recently, 2019, there was some, we'll wait on that just a second. So, yeah, here. So the wings were powered by reduced muscle mass. How do we know that? Well, you can actually just see how much muscle the rib cage or whatever, the bones can carry, right?
What does that mean, reduced?
Well, the bones can only carry so much weight. They can only carry so much muscle mass, right? So you can take, especially something like that flies. Birds are incredibly efficiently built.
Yeah.
Hollow bones, right? So they can fly. Okay. Lighter the better, right? Hollow bones.
Oh, and reduced muscle mass. Reduced
muscle mass. Or you can compare, and you'd also compare the bone structure in Archaeopteryx, the bone structure in, say, lizard-like animals, and it turned out that we know it had reduced muscle mass, so you probably just soared. That was the first notion. And then at the end of the glide, use those claws to grasp a tree. The thing is, this is a Vogten et al. 2018. This is in Nature. I think it was in Nature. But they did bone density studies, just looking at the power that could be achieved using different amounts of muscle and how much muscle could be this bone supports. And it turns out that if you look at the way the wings are built, they probably did short bursts of flight, but they probably didn't have to just jump and soar.
They didn't have to?
No. What they did is they did something very similar to what grouse do. Have you ever seen a grouse? Little birds, but they live in like on the ground, and they flap like crazy, get up in the air, and then they fly. That's probably what this thing did. Except not quite the same. Grouse flap their wings. Let's see. Well, all birds in general, they flap like that, right? Grouse as well. Archaeopteryx likely did it like this to get off the ground, and then flew normally. If you look at the way the skeleton's built. And it didn't fly for long. It's like real quick, frenetic, get away, and then land. Like it wasn't like it was going like a duck migrating somewhere and flying 500 kilometers in a day. Yep.
I was just thinking if it had to jump from a tree and land on another tree,
yeah.
I feel like eventually, it would have to be also good at climbing then.
Yeah.
So you could maybe look at like that sort of musculature, like could it sort of support itself?
And in fact, if you look at the that video that I'll send y'all, you'll see that that's one of the things about the tree hypothesis. It probably couldn't climb.
Yeah.
So soaring and grasping, fine, but how does it get up in the sky?
What if it doesn't land on a tree once?
Then it's probably just going to die.
Right?
So yeah. But then again, there's a lot of animals like that.
But it would have to be like a little flying squirrel, which could climb up a tree.
They climb, yes, they, exactly. But sometimes if a flying squirrel misses the next tree, it's dead.
Is it?
Sure.
Okay.
It's going to fall 40 or 50 meters, it's dead.
Okay.
Doesn't matter how, 40 or 50 meters, something that big, it's dead.
So it's going to be good at landing.
Yeah, exactly. It's going to be good at landing. It's also going to be good at doing quick calculations without knowing, doing those calculations of when should I put my hands into the grass, etc. Yeah. Maybe it had reptilian muscle. If it had reptilian muscle has 2 times the peak power of avian muscle.
Jesus.
So
The thing is, though, what happens with reptiles is they can do that for a very brief period, then they're like, okay, I gotta sit in the sun for a while. Well, that took a lot out of me, you know, because they're reptiles. Anybody here who has like a pet lizard or anything like that realizes that if it's not warm enough, it just sits there and you go, is it alive? Because they just sit completely still. They don't know where they go. Jeez, I guess it's alive. It probably didn't have that, because we now know that it did the flapping. Well, you don't know, pretty good guess, fair.
What kind of environment would they have lived in?
Basically, we're talking about Archaeopteryx lived in what we would today call Europe. The little carpets were kind of mashed up a little bit more. The world was warmer than it is now, greater than it is now, more oxygen than we have now. But it would have been the forest. Yeah, I would think so. Right. So Archaeopteryx is cool. What about us? Here's something interesting. Look at this thing we can do. Our closest relatives can't do this. Chimps can't walk on 2 feet. Well, they can for a while, but they walk like this. Right? That's how chimps and toddlers, that's how they walk. The best is when a toddler first learns to walk, and for the, because it's funny, when they first learn to walk, not even, they're babies still, right? They're about a year old, and they learn to walk, and they do it one day, and you just hope that mom or dad has a phone ready to video it, or in the old days, you go get the video camera. But they learn quickly that if you walk really fast, less chance of falling, eh? Because it's just centripetal force kind of thing. Babies are so weird. They're just real little babies going, and then one day they look at you and go, so what tax bracket are you in? Or something like this, they ask you a weird question. Like, what? How are you an adult? So chimps are quadrupeds. We're bipeds. 2 feet, right? But chimps are quadrupeds. Every other mammal's a quadruped. Every other placental mammal. Because some...
So like, if birds are walking around...
Yeah.
What, are they not bipedal?
They're not mammals. They're
birds. Every other mammal.
Yeah. And placental mammals, because you can think of kangaroos and stuff. Kangaroos don't really locomote on two. They're kind of a little bit of both.
Do they walk? How do they just like
jump? They hop and jump.
Just like casually?
Yeah. And they're like, what kangaroos have done is they filled in the niche for horses. There are no wild horses that evolved in Australia. But kangaroos are, in essence, marsupial horses. Like, every single animal you see that's in Australia, that you go, well, that's weird. We have the same animal, it's just that it looks different and it's not marsupial. Okay, except for platypuses, they're just freaking weird. So what's up with that? Like, how the hell, our closest living relative, 98% of our genes are the same, us and a chimp. And this is probably a bit closer with bonobos, quote pygmy chimps, as they're sometimes called, but they still are quadrupeds, they're not bipeds. If you look at the pelvis of different hominid species, which we can do, that's us, that's Australopithecus, and that's a chimp. Australopithecus stood up. If you see the way the pelvis is built, this is to allow for upright, to stand upright. This doesn't. Because of the way I don't know what these are called, the bone holes. I don't know. I never took anatomy and physiology. I don't give a crap. And you can also see the way that these are hands, whereas that's a foot. Like they're just different. So even back 5.5 billion years ago, Australopithecus had it was on 2 feet. It looked a lot like a chimp, but it was on 2 feet. Standing up is probably the most important thing that made us who we are. Right? Because once you stand up, your blood has to pump uphill, so your heart gets more powerful. And if your heart's powerful, the pump allows you to get a bigger brain. Right? So it's likely that bipedalism comes from or was, what was it, comes from, but our smarts came from our bipedalism. And then we also started cooking, which made a huge difference, and butchering animals, which made a huge difference. Other animals can't get inside. Other animals don't eat marrow. What we do is we crack it open and go, this is delicious. Yep.
May I ask sort of a silly question?
Of course.
Like that idea of human and psychedelic mushrooms. Have you ever thought about that or encountered that? Evolution, sort of human brain development as a result of experience.
Oh, I've heard about that. That seems ridiculous.
You think it's ridiculous?
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, I am all for legalizing every drug.
No. It's just,
but, and I really am. I think we should legalize heroin. But
at least decriminalize.
No, I think we should legalize it. I think the government should sell it. I don't give a crap. I think, and then you raise money and you make people not take heroin. And then you can also pay. And we're all adults. If you want to be stupid and take those things, do that. But what I'm saying is that, but if the idea that really drove us that much, that seems unlikely.
Maybe gives it too much credit. It's something to be like, oh, that's cool. But
it's something you see in a Reddit thread, and a lot of people go, yeah, this is awesome. My buddy did that.
Yeah, a lot of Joe Rogan.
But really, you'll find in general that Joe Rogan's an idiot.
I love it.
Yeah, well, he's an idiot. So the thing about standing up is it probably made us, like I said, who we are. In fact, the other thing it does is it makes the opening that the baby can fit through smaller. So babies, human babies, are born a lot less mature than even chimp babies. Chimp babies are also pretty altricial, like they need a lot of help too. But they don't need the kind of level of help that we all need. Right? Like if you took a human baby and just put it there, it'll be dead in a couple of days. Right? If you put a dog baby there, it'd probably a horse, and you're like, I'm a horse, what are we doing?
Yeah, sure.
They come out and they're going, wanna run? I feel like running. I'm 40 seconds old, wanna run? But see, our babies, they aren't finished yet. No, they aren't. They aren't done. They need so much more development.
Yeah,
human babies are stupidly, like,
they got no kneecaps.
They got nothing. Their head isn't done yet.
I was going to say that.
There's a, don't touch the soft spot.
Yeah.
Like, you really, people worry so much about these things. And they're usually new parents who worry about them. Don't look at the baby. Not so close. You could kill it. But yeah, babies are like, they are not finished yet. Whereas chimp babies are more finished, and like I said, if you take a look at a horse baby, they come out and they start running. Again, so now, look at how this all fits together. And now that gives us 12 or 15 years of teaching people a culture. Teaching people to hate people that are like them, but not exactly like them. That's most of what human culture is, I think. We should all just decide on a culture and I'll get that one. I just pick one. I don't care what it is. I'll learn a new one. Is the food good? All I care about is the food.
Yeah.
So then we talk about cowbirds. Generalist strategies in cowbirds. So the thing about cowbirds, I've talked about this, they're nest parasites. It would make sense that nest parasitism would start out as a specific strategy, parasitizing one potential host, right? So the more recent a cowbird has shown up in evolution, the more species it should parasitize. That's the logic here, okay? This actually turns out to be true. Here's a picture. So DNA studies show this to be true. We could actually, you look through what's called the molecular, you can look at using the molecular clock, it's called, and you can see how recent the mutation is. You can pretty good guess, okay? So you can actually see how recent these other cowbirds showed up. So time comes along here, says present past, this is the different kinds, this is the outgroup, and then we have the cowbirds. And the most recent one parasitizes the most species. So this is using the comparative method, but now throwing in modern molecular techniques. This. You don't have to do, right? You didn't have to go from the flag. That made sense how that happened. This makes sense here, but now we can actually reconstruct this tree
and go from there. And there's a lot of data on bird evolution and DNA. And the reason for that is that, and all kinds of bird species names and taxonomy was changed in the early 1990s, because all the molecular methods got cheaper, and a couple of people decided they were going to redo the birds. So Sibley and Alquist, and it was just like, oh, it was a big thing when, well, anybody who studied birds, it was like, oh yeah, now my species name changed, etc. So we've looked at all these things. All right, so finish this up, and then we'll talk a little bit about adaptation. So you can reconstruct evolution of behavior or any other trait. This also works for, you know, the length of a tail, or stripes, or whatever the hell it is, just we're using it for behavior, using this comparative method. You can't be entirely sure, of course, until I develop my time machine. There's no way we'll ever know. And I've said too much already about the time machine. But, so there's no way we can actually know. But we can make some really good guesses. But you'll see in that video again, I'm clearly pumping the tires of this video. We can be wrong, but the cool thing is, we get better and better at getting closer to the answer. So the molecular methods can really help us with even behavior, which I think surprises a lot of people, because I don't think most people think about molecular genetics and behavior, but it really has been very valuable. Questions on this before we move on to talk a bit about adaptation?
When you say behavior or any trait, earlier you were saying like the phenotype is just like basically a collection of traits.
That's all, yeah, that's
so
your phenotype.
Like behavior is sort of nested within the phenotype.
It's,
as well.
Behavior is part of your phenotype, it's as much as your color of your eyes.
Okay.
Yep. Yep. And again, that doesn't necessarily always mean that something's 100% genetic, blah, blah, blah. It just means it's your outward characteristics.
Outward characteristics, that's a good.
Yeah, yeah. So it's what you see, what you can observe.
Okay.
Is one way to look at it. I mean, it's probably stuff you can't observe that also is there, but generally, I think that's a way to look at it.
Yeah, okay.
All right. So, where is, oh, where's my mouse pointer? What, oh, I left. Now, where is it? Oh, there it is. Now, when I go, I think I put it, no, there it is. Is it this way? Nope, so it must be this way. Or not, where is it?
Are you looking for the cursor?
Yeah. Oh, does it go down?
Yes.
No, it doesn't go down. No, but I'm saying I'm trying to find it. I got to get it onto my other monitor, onto my laptop, so I can. Oh, there it is. Okay, good. Stupid thing. All right. Let's see. Adaptation. There you are.
Where is it?
All right. We won't get this done today, and that's fine. We may. It's possible. I'm not trying to rush anybody, so you know, don't feel like you can't ask questions. Yeah. So, last class, or mere moments ago, we talked about, let's call it historical pathways of a behavior, or any trait really, but we're interested in behavior. How do we get from one form to the other? Right? So let's look at the adaptive value, in other words, the fitness consequences of different behaviors. And obviously, again, these things are going to be related because if the fitness was, if it wasn't a positive fitness consequence, it likely wouldn't be here. Now, don't always say just because something exists, it must be an adaptation, it must have positive fitness consequences, because things don't have to have positive fitness consequences to exist. They, in fact, could be negative and are being actively selected against in the environment right now. Right? Or some things are just neutral. Okay, here's a definition of adaptation. An adaptation is a behavior, is a heritable trait either spread because of natural selection or has been maintained by selection to the present, or is currently spreading to alternative traits due to natural selection. I don't know why I'm capitalizing natural selection there, but yeah, it's a little weird. Okay. So those are, I think, sensible enough definitions. Both of those are good. So it's either been spread because of selection and it's being kept there now, or it's currently spreading
and becoming, it's just currently spreading and replacing others. We can think of a great one in humans. Lactose, like the enzyme in humans and all other animals to digest milk, to digest the sugar lactose, which is in milk. It's called lactase, and mammals all make lactase until the mammal is not a baby anymore. Then they don't make lactase anymore. But about 5,000 years ago, we started, maybe 6,000 years ago, humans started being able to drink milk past babyness, early childhood. And that's been quite an adaptation because it's allowed us to drink cow's milk. Big thing. It's a very recent thing in human evolution. So it's spreading right now. And it's adaptive because now I have an extra source of food. Right? Okay. So the nice thing about the definition like this is that it allows us to see if something actually is an adaptation. Does it increase fitness relative to other strategies, other characteristics? If so, it's an adaptation. If it does not increase fitness, then we have no evidence that it's an adaptation. Make sense? All right. So what we're going to do is we're going to look at the costs and benefits of different behaviors versus their alternatives and see if it's beneficial to do X, Y, or Z. And if it is and has positive fitness consequences, we can call something an adaptation. But just because something exists doesn't make an adaptation. And there are, mutations that are deleterious that are still around too, right? So things that are bad. So just because it exists now doesn't make it an adaptation. It could, in fact, be a bad thing. I have a genetic disorder that's not good for me, but it actually probably has no fitness consequences anymore. There was a time when it did, before sunscreen was invented and before clothes were invented. It's very bad. It killed you pretty quickly. It doesn't do that anymore, right? So albinism, human ocular cutaneous albinism, variant 1, is not an adaptation, but it also isn't really negative for me, in my case. Right? It probably actually has negative fitness consequences generally. So not all traits are adaptations, right? And there's a couple reasons for that. The trait, the conditions the trait evolved in may not exist. And this is there's the example right there. I don't live in sub-Saharan Africa. 50,000 years ago. So this is fine. Now, something could be a maladaptive side effect of an adaptive trait. So you'll hear people say sometimes, this is oftentimes about human disorders, they'll say something like, schizophrenia is too much creativity. But people say things like that, right? You'll hear people say that autism is too much of a analytical mind, and there's something to be said for that, potentially. Being analytical is good. Doing it to the point of all you do is memorize plane crashes all day isn't as good. Those of you who are in 2606, and my son is in that class. You ask him sometime if you know him. Ask him about a plane crash. Any plane crash ever. He'll tell you the names of the pilots. It's kind of neat and weird at the same time, but the best part of it is, you know that show Mayday Air Crash Disasters? The narrator of that, I went to high school with him. So I contacted him, and he sent my son a script and a whole bunch of other stuff. It was kind of cool. Yeah, it was deep.
So when you said that thing about schizophrenia, you said it's not. But then when you spoke about autism, you said it could be.
Yeah, it could be.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean,
There is evidence that schizophrenia runs in families, first thing.
Yeah.
But schizophrenics aren't any more creative than non-schizophrenics.
Yeah.
However, schizophrenics' siblings are more creative, so there's still maybe something there.
Really?
Yeah. There might be something there.
Creative as in like artistic?
Don't ask me what creativity means.
Okay.
Because no one really knows.
Okay.
So it's measured like 8 million different ways, so I don't even... Yeah, it's...
It's just something interesting to think about.
Oh, it is. It's explaining schizophrenia is something that, you know, if you figure that out, you'll help a lot of people. Trait may be an exaptation. An exaptation is when something has evolved for one purpose, and then it's taken over for something else. The feathers are the perfect example. Feathers were originally for thermoregulation, and then flight took them. Evolution works with what's in front of it. Were feathers an adaptation for flying? No. Are flight feathers an adaptation for flying? Yes. Okay. So how are we going to measure fitness? Because if we're going to do this, we have to measure fitness, because if it's got fitness consequences. And these are just things that came off the top of my head when I was making up this slide a few years back. How do we measure fitness? Well, the obvious direct one is how many babies do you have? But you can't always do that. These are going to be highly correlated with these things. Gamete production, obviously. Well, offspring survival. Rate of copulation, okay. Fertilized egg production in a female, that's good. I got offspring survival, offspring production. Offspring independence. And then you can go even further. You can say offspring surviving into the adult, you know, breeding population and breeding is even better.
So you can make it kind of like a cycle. Then.
You can go off. So these are direct measures of fitness. It's not always easy. It's possible sometimes. That's more of a lab situation. You're not gonna, a lot of field stuff, you're not gonna be able to get all these data, or any of these data. Now, indirectly though, might be better. Improve locomotion. You run faster, you can find food better, you can get away from predators, that's all good. More access to food, more survival chances. What do I mean? Well, overnight. Right? So sometimes when animals go to sleep, they're pretty vulnerable, right? They're pretty vulnerable when they're asleep. For a lot of reasons. Not just getting eaten by bigger things. I mean, it's things like just surviving the night because you're not eating for 8 hours or 10 hours. When you're a little tiny animal, not eating for a few hours can kill you. Like, think about a hummingbird going to sleep. They better get something to eat pretty quickly in the morning. Their hearts beat 400 times a minute. They're pretty energetic little animals. You know, the hearts are that big. They're not big animals. But I've told you about chickadees, how they need to eat, but 30 minutes after they wake up or they starve to death. What else do we have? Access to territories, or better territories. And these, again, just things that I just thought up. And I've seen other things used too, there's a few. Okay, let's talk about mobbing in gulls. So one of the things that gulls will do is if you get near their breeding grounds, and a lot of gulls nest communally, so they big nest colonies and they're all out nesting. If you come near the nest colony, they'll attack you. I'd be more afraid of this than I would of an Archaeopteryx coming at me. Because when a whole bunch of gulls come at you and start pooping on you on purpose, like their Stukas going after Polish army troops in World War II, or they just swoop down, and they'll just swoop down and they'll fly right over your head and kind of whew. That's disturbing. Sometimes they'll fly right into your head on purpose. If you ever see a whole bunch of gulls and it's like spring, go that way. Don't go that way. Yep.
I was thinking, could you kind of think of that sort of hawk versus dove situation then?
Well, they're actually they're acting like hawks
because
they're fighting. Yeah,
like
you could.
They didn't do that, you know.
Yeah.
Maybe their eggs get eaten or whatever.
Well, we're gonna look at that in a moment.
That's cool.
Yeah. Best guess here is this is an adaptation for defense of their young. I mean, that's pretty clearly what it must be. But we can't see these until we have evidence. Right? You hear this all the time. This is one of the cases where this clearly looks like it must be, but we do need the evidence. We can't just say it is because it feels right. So does mobbing increase fitness? That's what we're going to ask here. Okay. So the degree of success by mobbing gulls who are protecting their eggs must be proportional to the degree to which predators are mobbed, right? The more you mob, the safer your eggs. That makes sense, right? Okay. Well, let's take a look. So, they're always Dutch, weird Dutch names. Tested this year before I was born. Took 10 hen eggs and placed them every 10 meters on a line outside and inside a gull colony. And then took a look and saw which ones were taken and which ones weren't taken, and the ones outside the colony were less likely to be, ones outside the colony were more likely to be taken. The notion is that they aren't defending that area, so predators will come along and eat them. And you can actually see the data here. I just think it's creek. So that's outside the colony. That's inside the colony. You can just see the data here. It's pretty clear. So that's the first indication that it sounds like this is an adaptation for that. Well, let's continue on. Now, here's something cool. Barn swallows also mob. Not just gulls. Barn swallows mob as well. Okay. Maybe that's just self-defense, or again, it could be a mating advertisement. It could be like a mating dance, right? Because we know about birds and singing, we think of bird song as being a mating strategy. It may also be the case here that this behavior is something that a potential mate would find attractive, which makes a lot of sense, because so if you're mobbing, you're going to protect our young. It could be an alternative to actual direct parental care. Right? It'd be like, okay, kids, you stay here, we'll be over here keeping the bad guys away, you find some food. Like, it's parental care, perhaps. I love animal behavior experiments where they take stuffed animals and put them places. Now, this is not a stuffed owl that looks like a toy. This is a stuffed owl, stuffed barn owl. And put it near a colony of barn swallows and took note of who did the mobbing, who attacked the stuffed owl. Sounds like the name of Agatha Christie's worst book, Who Attacked the Stuffed Owl. All I can tell you is if it's Agatha Christie, it's the person you least likely think did it. You ever read Agatha Christie books?
Yes.
When you find out about two books in, it's the person who clearly didn't do it, they did it. Then they stop being fun. Because that's the formula. Hey, data. Mobbing by barn swallows individuals of various types present in study colonies actually participating in mobbing. Okay. And that's from this very same paper. This is the percentage of the population being adult, unmated 6, adults before incubation 9, during incubation 14, adults with young 51, juvenile 20. So these are teenagers, basically. They're sexually mature, but they don't get mates. And then let's look and see. Okay. That's about the same, 6 and 2. 9 and 11, let's look the same. That's good. Oh, look, adults with young, 77%. And look who does no mobbing. The juveniles who actually could have young, but they don't have any young. They do no mobbing at all. And these ones do the lion's share of the mobbing. So it seems pretty clear with barn swallows that this is a way for them to protect their young. Not their eggs and not their mates. So this is telling us right away. Is this something to do with mating? No. Is this something to do with incubation? No. Is it something to do with just being an adult or being old enough to? No. Is it protecting your young? Yes. See, so we wouldn't have known this, and we would have just been guessing. Now we know. So again, with the comparative method, we can look at the evolution of a lot of these behaviors. And we can, usually just partially, we can answer these questions about the evolution of various behaviors using the comparative method. We would expect that birds that are, who are cliff nesters, a friend named Cliff, and I just imagine birds nesting on his bald head, and it's interesting. Nail that happen. We would assume that cliff nesters wouldn't mob where that ground nesters would. Because who mobs? Ground nesters, big colonies. Cliff nesters don't have to mob. You know why? You're not on a cliff. No one's coming after you. You're safe. That's your strategy for protecting your young. Go nest somewhere where no one's going to be nearby. You all right? All right. So relatedness shouldn't matter. So let's take a look. So this is in fact the case that if we look here, when we look at mobbing, the common ancestor of gulls and barn swallows was quite a while ago. It wasn't Archaeopteryx, but it wasn't a whole lot after that. It was millions and millions of years ago. The ancestry is not what's making the different species mob. The convergent evolution thing that's going on here, right? That's where the important stuff's happening. This is saying that if you mob in a colony on the ground, or sorry, if you nest in a colony on the ground, you will evolve mobbing behavior. And both barn swallows and herring gulls have done this. That's called convergent evolution, when distantly related species evolve the same strategy for solving some evolutionary problem. We call that convergent evolution. And sometimes we'll see closely related species that evolve different strategies. That's called divergent evolution. There are even colonial mammals who mob. So there are mammals like little squirrels and stuff that have big nesting areas. Okay, and they nest on the ground, and then there is mobbing. They have guards, they have guard squirrels, they send out warning calls, and then there's mobbing. Pretty cool. All right.
Like colonial mammal, that means like ones that like live in groups, right?
Yeah, they more than anything, it means they nest in nesting colonies.
Okay, cool.
So when you think about gulls, you think penguins are colonial nesters. Well, most gulls are. Barn swallows, ground squirrels. Yeah. Okay. The question you can ask is, when does it make sense to use a particular strategy? And the way we're going to figure that out is by using what's called an optimality model. So you could also ask, when does it make sense to evolve a strategy? That's a strange question, because it's like the animal doesn't decide to evolve it. And evolution doesn't decide anything. So decision here isn't having the same meaning that we would normally think. Maybe I should say, when would it show up? But you actually see the word decide being used in the literature. We'll look at the costs and benefits, and we'll do that through the use of an optimality model. Basically, that's all this is. And we're going to get, you can see that math's going to be really important here, because the math's going to allow us to figure out what the right amount of X, Y, and Z are. So we have to go model this. There's not going to be any math, but there's going to get a little mathy for a second. Okay. All right, let's just pull that up as well. So, when do you mob? Because you would mob every single time. You only mob when they're getting close. You're not going to mob when they're half a kilometer away. It's like, well, we're fine here. And you'll see what we would do in this case is you can build a benefit and cost. The benefits are linear. The costs aren't. Because at some point it costs everything. It can't cost more than everything. That's the notion here, right? So this top model looks at costs and benefits, and it says, when will you mob? When these two curves are the furthest apart. And then we can look at a cautious mobber would mob when we're close together. And a daring mobber is going to move when they're far apart. There's no reason to mob here. Not much of a reason, right? Because it's pretty far away. The benefits are, the costs are really low though, so why would you even do this? But some will be able to call that strategy a cautious mob. The bottom one here looks at the average of cautious and daring mobbers. So take a look here. This is the cautious guy, this is the daring guy, and this is the relative fitness that they get. Okay, and then along the x-axis, that's the x-axis, percentage of cautious mobbers, right? So they're going to be dependent on each other. It's an ESS. Of course it's an ESS. So there's two possible strategies here, be cautious or be daring. And it makes sense to be daring if everybody's cautious. It makes sense to be cautious if everybody's daring. And where's it going to equal out? Right there, right where the two lines cross. The intersection of two functions. You might think to yourself, I remember learning about that in grade 10 math, and I thought, this will never come up again. It just did. System of two equations, and you're solving for it. You thought, and you said to your teacher, we'll never use this in real life, and your teacher said, I don't care. I'm just here for the paycheck. I don't know what they said, and I don't care. So adaptation, looking at things from adaptation's viewpoint is something that people get pretty critical of. Big critic was Stephen Jay Gould. Stephen Jay Gould is the only paleontologist to have ever appeared on The Simpsons. So we'll give him some credit there. He also invented came up with the idea of exaptation. That's his, the idea of evolution taking something that's already evolved and taking it for another purpose. Steve also was a huge baseball fan. Just thought I'd throw that in there. The Ken Burns baseball documentary, he's all over it. Now, he said, maybe the trade is now adaptive now, but was adaptive before. So it may be that something was an adaptation and isn't anymore. So you got to keep that in mind. The trait, I shouldn't say trail, I should say trait. I'm going to fix that right now because it's going to bug me until I fix it. So there we go. That fixed it. Ha ha! Whoops. So these are all possibilities. He was also a communist. He was. He was a communist. I got two friends who were communists. That's a little weird. It's a little weird. I do podcasts with two different communists. Isn't that weird? And they're both on old television shows.
That's cool.
It's also why. Sorry, two, three. I lose track.
You have like a collection going.
I do like 9 or 8 of them, including the lectures, which are by far the most popular. By far. Okay. The trait maybe never would have shown up, but really, maybe crazy conditions now have made it show up. So maybe because the world's changed so much recently, things have changed. This is the one, this is one of his weirdest criticisms. The other criticisms are fine. They're fine. I think they're overblown, but they're fine. This one I don't understand. This is the idea that the trait is less than perfect because it's constrained by past evolutionary events. I don't ever remember anybody saying evolution was perfect. It's a very weird criticism that Gould levels here, I find. So an assumptionist of the adaptationist approach is that we will test, we don't know it's an adaptation until we test a prediction to see if it is an adaptation, right? And I don't know where that perfectness thing comes from. It's really weird. I'm really confused by it. See, the point is not about being correct so much as being testable and proved wrong. And that's, this is just me saying that I think Gould's off base. The idea here is you're supposed to find things that are testable. Looking at this is testable. We don't do essentialist kind of thing. It just doesn't work like that. That's just not how science tends to work. Well, we're going to get done both these topics in one day. That's fine with me, but I don't care. So let's finish it up. Don't be a rabbit. That's all that said. Don't be a rabbit adaptationist. One of the worst things you can do is think that every single thing you see is an adaptation. It isn't. Okay? And one of the, and I know when I talk about this stuff, when I talk about human evolutionary psychology, I say this all the time. It's like, not everything you see is an adaptation. A lot of stuff just is.
I've kind of fallen into that personally sometimes.
I think we all do when we first learn about this stuff, especially. Because it's exceedingly powerful. And you can, it's so easy to make up stories about the past that you can't test and don't know if they're true or not. Yeah. Oh no, that's, so don't be a rabid adaptationist. Not everything is true, everything is rabid adaptation. Don't fall for the naturalistic fallacy either. So don't think because it's an adaptation, it is therefore good. Because it's natural, it's good. Just because things are natural doesn't make them good. It doesn't make them bad either. It just makes them exist. So yeah, is it true that, let's see, what's something that's natural, it's good for you? I don't know, how about water? That's pretty good. You know what else is natural? Big pile of shit. You wouldn't want to eat that. That'd be weird. Or do anything with it. But it's still natural. Oh, it's natural. It doesn't matter. You know what else is natural? Benzene. Yeah. Go load up on benzene. It's natural. It's even literally organic. So just, you gotta be really careful about both ends of this, which is not everything because it's natural is good, but not everything just because it also exists doesn't make it, quote, natural, you know what I mean? This is all about reproductive success. So we need the adaptationist approach, I think, to see why and if something evolved. Does it affect fitness? And if it does, then we can talk. And of course, this stuff is clearly intertwined with all the historical pathway stuff we talked about earlier. All right, questions? Boy, that didn't take long. I've done two today. Oh well. Okay, that'll do it, and I'll talk to you all next time.
So thanks for listening to the lecture. I hope you got something out of it, as I noted in the intro. These are copyrighted, share alike 3.0 Canada, some rights reserved. So you can redistribute this all you want, but if you redistribute it, you can't make any money off of it. And also, if you mash it up, I get to mash up your stuff. Most of the vast majority of the music I found was on an old website called GarageBand, which doesn't exist anymore. And then it was called PodSafe Music. So this is all music that I have, that it's perfectly reasonable to put on these podcasts. If you are interested, I can oftentimes find the name of the band. The name of the band will be listed in the post. And go look these bands up and buy their music, because if they're cool enough to let me use this, you should be cool enough to pay 99 cents or whatever to buy one of their songs. On that note, I will see you next time.